Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I have a very upbeat, creative, positive guest today, and I kind of need him today. I just did the two media shows before this one, and one of them, by the way, actually was ended up being very positive. It's on PBS, and I'm going to try to get it up on our Facebook page, my professional Facebook page, about the growing problem, it grows and grows, of giving psychiatric drugs to children, in this case, the stimulants. Now, in 1972, the U.S. Congress, the House of Representatives, held hearings on the epidemic of diagnosing kids as hyperactive and giving them stimulant drugs, including the mainstays we give today, the methylphenidate or Ritalin drugs, and Adderall and amphetamine drugs. This epidemic, which they lamented in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1972, reached an estimated 100,000 kids. We've got multi-millions, 6, 7, 8, I don't think we really know, on these drugs now. And we've never had again a hearing in the U.S. Congress that had so much protest and controversy as way back in 72. In other words, there's been less. The PBS show today, I think, is a breakthrough in presenting a variety of views and giving me a good voice along with the establishment voice from the professor who is, needless to say, as he admitted, funded by the drug companies. Later in the show, I'll try to remember to give you the radio station so that you can go there yourself. But in the meanwhile, I wanted to just introduce the subject a little further. What stimulated the show was a recent CDC, Centers for Disease Control, study involving canvassing a large number of teenagers. It was found out that 2 out of 10, just about 20% of teenage high schoolers, boys, 14 to 17, have been diagnosed with ADHD. 2 out of 10, 1 out of 5. Sit in a classroom of 30 kids, and you got a substantial number then on these drugs. Overall, it was about a 6% rate of this diagnosis, but that's including little children and boys and girls. Now, I want to go back in time and remind you about something, which is that there have been a lot of studies trying to show that Ritalin works, and none have succeeded. And the culminating study of all was done by the federal government with a bunch of old boy guys. It's called the MTA study. You can look it up and go ahead and just put in quotes MTA. You'll get to these studies and find the one that describes the final outcome. It's called a 3-year follow-up of the NIMH MTA study. After 36 months, what'd they find after 3 years? There was no improvement in the lives in any way of the children on these psychiatric drugs compared to other kids. And, of course, they had lost height and weight, and lots of other things happened to them because these drugs are very toxic, which they didn't bother to count. So no good effect, lots of bad effects. 20% of boys, 14 to 17, being diagnosed with most of them obviously on these drugs. Now, one other study that's interesting that comes out about all this, and it relates to the violence issues. You know, suicide and violence are very closely related, and I've been concerned that these, I've raised concerns that almost every single shooter has been through the psychiatric system, one or two exceptions out of dozens, and many of them on psychiatric drugs, and they commit violence and usually suicide as well. Well, there's a new study out in January, pretty new, in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, by NOCK, N-O-C-K, and others. And they looked at adolescents to examine suicidality. And, of course, suicidal feelings and suicide happen to children, especially starting around age 11 or 12. The rates of this study were very similar to adult rates. But what they found was that the majority of these people reported having suicidal feelings after they got into psychiatric or mental health treatment of some kind or another. More than half. So much for hoping that if we just ramp up psychiatry and pass all our kids through it, that they're going to turn out better and less menacing to us. Okay. Well, my guest. Oh, and don't forget our conference. Please don't forget our conference. April 26th to 28th. Go to empathictherapy.org. April 26th to 28th, a fabulous conference. Both the black side, the dark side of criticizing psychiatry, and the bright, happy, glowing side of lots of better ways to help people, including children and families. So now to my guest, Chris Stankovich, S-T-A-N-K-O-B-I-C-H. This is the second time I've had him on the show. I haven't had too many folks on twice. I like non-mental health people, but he's kind of a mental health guy, as you'll see, but he's kind of not. He's really interesting. He is the founder of Advanced Human Performance Systems. The nice thing about being named Stankovich or Bregan is all you got to do is put in Stankovich, and right away, without even his name, first name, or founder of Advanced Human Performance Systems, you'll find him. And he does sports science and performance and enhanced training work and counseling athletes and coaches and sports administrators and teams. Graduate of Ohio State University. He is a mental healther. I forgive him. He's like me. He's a licensed professional clinical counselor, which, by the way, are the folks I tend to like the best. Every university I've taught in, I don't know, six or seven or whatever, I haven't counted them, but mostly I teach in departments of counseling. Counseling has a good tradition behind it. Now, you know, he's been on other shows. He's been on ABC World News and Fox Sports. He's been in USA Today, but has he been there twice? I don't know. He's twice on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Chris Stankovich, hello.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
You can see I'm almost a little hyper today after having been on a panel with debate on the PBS and having done another hour on a Good Natural Doctor show and all this data coming out. I want you to entertain us. Not exactly. I mean, what do you think about drugging kids? What do you think about performance enhancement? It was interesting. The DEA, they had a DEA person on the show today, and she, the professor, she talked about, is it even ethical to give children drugs that for at least a very short period of time, as she put it, will maybe improve their work on a test? I don't know that the data is on her side because it really produces over-focusing. But assuming that it works briefly, is it even ethical? Now, in sports, we say no, don't we?
Yeah. Well, I'd actually like to answer that question and throw out a wider net to what you're asking. You know, it's interesting in doing my counseling work for almost 20 years now, I've certainly seen a massive paradigm shift in the therapeutic process, what the responsibilities are on our end therapeutically, and also the expectations by the clients that I see, both athlete and non-athlete as well. And anymore in 2013, it just seems as though every which way I turn with clients here, the majority of them, particularly the teenage kids that I see, are on something, whether it is, you know, an ADHD-related concern, a mood disorder, something that I haven't even had a chance to share with you yet. Here in Ohio, I'm teaming up with the Attorney General to try to develop better efforts to raise awareness to the pain pill issue that we are now seeing, where increasingly more student athletes are experiencing injuries. There's nothing new there, but in the path of rehabilitation that follows, sometimes they're put on, you know, very powerful pain medications, opiate-based pain medications that they become addicted to, and when their prescriptions run out, in some cases they continue to buy these drugs off the street, or worse yet, they turn to the cheaper alternative, heroin. And so it just seems as though everywhere I turn, I'm up against something drug-related, which, as you might imagine, makes it even that much more difficult to reach the young people I work with and make effective, positive change.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Most of the kids you see, I'm not all surprised. And by the way, I got the information on the show. Things are moving so fast that I was on PBS today. It was at 2:15 to 2:45. You can hear a traditional drug company psychiatrist. You can hear a parent who thinks the drug saved her life but really appreciates my work, saved her child's life, but very much appreciates my work, which is a kind of an ambiguous, ambivalent situation. And also a professor who works with the DEA on just how addictive the drugs are. It's the show is called To the Point on KCRW. It's To the Point, and the host is Warren Olney, O-L-N-E-Y, To the Point, KCRW, out of L.A. on the West Coast. And it's something to really look at and pass around. So, you know, it is still illegal, isn't it, for athletes on any level to use these drugs as performance enhancers? And isn't it just illegal for them to use it all on the level of at least Olympics? But what's the story? What's the story on using amphetamines and amphetamine-like stimulant drugs?
Yeah, that kind of evolves as the games evolve, so to speak. But I think most of your, well, certainly Olympic level and most of your professional sports leagues are fairly aggressive as far as, you know, making efforts to control athletes who cheat by using performance-enhancing supplements. As you're aware, I'm sure, Major League Baseball took many, many years to clean up the games there. It's supposedly a lot better today than it was, you know, 5 or 10 years ago when it was speculated that the majority of guys in Major League Baseball were using
something. But we know it's better, right, because the home run hitting has gone down drastically.
Dramatically, I know. And, well, and I think that, you know, conspiracy theorists will certainly talk that in the mid-90s after the last baseball strike, the fact that these guys could hit so many home runs is probably what put butts back in seats. So, you know, it served a purpose in that time.
There you go.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're really up against the drug movement on so many different fronts, whether it's performance enhancement directly, hitting a ball farther, whether it's used to more quickly remedy a sport-related injury, as you've already talked about in the show today, just normal everyday people who are prescribed meds for moods and anxieties. And, you know, it just, again, it seems as though everywhere you turn, you're up against some kind of drug that is supposed to replace self-healing or working effectively with a therapist of some kind.
So you work with kids. You help them improve their athletic lives, and I'm sure do a lot more. Just tell us about that. Tell us what you do, and tell us what kids need, because we need to be reminded what they need rather than diagnoses and drugs.
Sure. Yeah, I like to look at the sport experience to serve as a vehicle for life success for kids. And, of course, there's so much fun that occurs for kids to be running around and participating on the team. But I take it beyond that. I think there are countless athletic transferable skills skills that kids learn in sports, often they learn without even knowing that they're learning these skills, how to focus under pressure, how to work successfully with teammates, how to bounce back from a loss. Well, ironically, these are the very same skills that are necessary for academic success, for life success. But the problem has always been parlaying those experiences. And I find that for the majority of young people, because they do these things so often and so regularly, they take them for granted, or they falsely assume that other kids in their school who are not involved in sports also learn these skills. And so, you know, it's exciting for me to help a young person make the connection. For example, if a youngster can get up at the end of a baseball game and, you know, make the winning hit and he delivers for his team and he was able to stay calm and confident in that situation, well, that skill set is the very same skill set he'll need the next time he has to give a speech before his class when he might become nervous. And so it's really helping them take a self-inventory and then using those skills in every aspect of life.
Well, it's a good model. Tell us some more about the skills. What are they? What are they composed of psychologically, spiritually, mentally, that enables a child to stand up in front of a class or stand up at the plate? Or because, you know, I agree with you. I think it's very much related to also standing up on moral and psychological issues. I, you know, I'm only 5'4", Chris, and I was 135. Well, let's see, when I ran track, I was about 130 pounds. When I played football, I was about 142 pounds. And I got into a number of physical confrontations as a youngster because I was short, Jewish, and president of the class, and playing football. So there were people who wanted to prove something to this short Jewish boy who was president of the class and playing football. And I learned to fight extremely well. And I think that the physicality of some of my childhood really helped distinguish me when it came to having courage compared to a lot of other so-called intellectuals. I've never discussed this in public before, at least on the air. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a safe environment to learn so many skills, and I think you really hit the nail on the head with your comments there. I'm a big believer in, you know, Al Bandura's model of self-efficacy. I think, you know, setting and achieving small goals each and every day, it allows us to look inward and see the abilities that we have, and also to focus on the future and develop convictions toward the things that we want to achieve and accomplish. And I think sports allows for that. You know, if a kid has a bad game or loses the game, there's always another game tomorrow. And I think it's a safe environment for that. I think the challenge that we all have, families especially, is really understanding, I guess, the gauntlet of the average youngster's sport career. Unfortunately, you know, the odds of going on post high school are very, very small. And then, as you might imagine, even smaller to go on to the professional ranks. And what's sometimes sad about that is when families leave behind, you know, all of these great experiences and just kind of wrap them up in a box and put them away. When in my experience, you know, I have seen so many people go on from their successful sport careers to go on to even more successful post-sports careers. And so, you know, I think, again, it's just how you use this experience, and I think it can be used in a very healthy and successful way if you're active in the process.
How do you personally help a child who's panicking under pressure, which I think a lot of the issues in childhood are about? Yep. Kids who are angry and kids who are labeled as being oppositional, defiant, and ADHD. And a lot of times, they're just dealing with a lot of anxiety, and they're not going to tell you, I'm scared to death, I'm scared to death, I'm stupid, I'm scared I can't do this, I'm scared I can't do that, I'm ashamed of my behaviors. Instead of doing that, they just act up.
Yep.
That makes sense?
He always does. And, you know, I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is peeling back the labels that increasingly more kids are given every day. You know, every every time I see a youngster come in with his or her family and they want to immediately tell me, well, my kid's got ADHD, and it's like this permanent tattoo on the kid's head. And of course it creates a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it implies a disease model that can only be treated by drugs, and it kind of prompts you to throw out the window any of the cognitive behavioral techniques that we know work. And so that's the first challenge. And, you know, the second part of it, getting past that, is helping youngsters identify the type of fear that they experience. Because in my practice, we talk a lot about choking. And you know, you hear that term used with sports a lot, but really it happens in all areas of life. And so what is choking? It's the inability to perform a task that you know you can and you have experience performing the task in the past, but you're unable to do it, you know, in real-life situations. So, for example, if a basketball player can go out and shoot 80% of his free throws in practice, but then he gets in games and he's making only 40%, nothing's changed. They haven't moved the hoop up any higher. They haven't deflated the ball, but pressure has crept in. And so what I try to do is help youngsters understand the type of fear they're experiencing, and, you know, I always break it down into two types. There's real fear, you know, when you are truly in harm's way, but that's rarely the type of fear that athletes experience, ironically. It's the irrational fear that really troubles them. What will my coach think? Will my parents be let down if I don't play well? What's my girlfriend going to think in the crowd if I miss this next shot? You know, and I think once they start to take control of the process and understand that these irrational fears really don't put me in any jeopardy. Yeah, I might have a bruised ego for a day, but who hasn't? Who hasn't been in a situation like this? And so we normalize it, we get away from those stigmas and titles, and really help them employ some hands-on strategies that can help them succeed.
I love what you just said about how when the chips are down, the fears are social fears about the coach, about the girlfriend, about the parents, and a lot about shame. I think that the shame is the biggest impediment there is to creativity, whether it's having your own radio show or shooting fouls in the middle of a game. And it's just so important to come back to. It's about our relationship with other people that so often is the key to success and failure. And, of course, you see it with these young kids on the basketball court. Not even the young kids, the pros. They lose their temper. They get inside each other's heads. They blow it over perceived shame and relationship. Do you talk about shame consciously with the athletes you work with?
I think when it's appropriate, when it comes up, we do. I try to, in my own philosophy, is try to get kids, all kinds for that matter, really geared toward forward thinking rather than looking in the rearview mirror and hanging on to the things that we can't change. I mean, we want to acknowledge those things. We want to learn from those things. But to camp out there is not typically a good place. And so I instead try to help people understand by using examples. In fact, one of the things that I normally talk about when giving lectures or even working with people one-on-one at the practice, you know, is get in the habit every year of picking up a couple autobiographies of people you look up to, whether it's athletes, musicians, celebrities, politicians, what have you. But if you really read a person's autobiography, and I think you'll agree with this, you'll read far more stories of stress and frustration and adversity and failure than you will success. You know, I remember a couple years ago, my wife bought me the Steve Jobs book. And, I mean, here's a guy who literally changed the world with so many of his creations through Apple. But, my goodness, he had so many places where he could have quit early in the game. I mean, in fact, he was fired from his own company. Michael Jordan's another example. You know, the famous story of him being cut from his high school basketball team. So I think when we become aware that it's typically not a straight ascension to success, but there's a lot of peaks and valleys, it normalizes it, and I think it provides some confidence to people.
Yeah, and it also makes ridiculous the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, because you couldn't read a serious autobiography where the person wasn't displaying patterns of behavior that would fit into that, which nowadays would get them drugged or locked up. Because life is tough. Human nature is very unruly. It takes a lot to discipline ourselves. And we really, really need to look at that straight in the eye, just how unruly we are in our nature and how hard we have to work to discipline and grow up and be ethical and, you know, be good at what we do and so on.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and that's a challenge. I think we all would love to know that there are quick fixes to our problems. I mean, there's nothing wrong with trying to save a little time, energy, and money. But the reality is that usually doesn't exist. You know, in my world working with athletes, you know, they don't just go into the weight room one time and all of a sudden they're in great physical condition. And I think that the same is true on the mental health side. But again, as you alluded to, and we've got a new DSM coming out here soon, you know, I'm already nervous about how the loosening of the criteria is going to occur, the widening of the diagnoses, you know, just again cementing that paradigm that in order to fix these problems, you know, you need to be on something. You know, the onus of responsibility is taken away from the client. There's not much you can do. You're doomed. But here's a pill that can help. And I think it's so complex, and to the average layperson, I can see how you can get caught up in that.
Yes, absolutely. We've got a few minutes before break, not too many minutes. I'm talking with Chris Stankovich, the founder of Advanced Human Performance Systems. Chris, tell us a little bit about your books, your workbooks and products.
Well, you know, at the website, drstankovich.com, you'll find a number of different books. Most are geared towards sports, but I want to make sure people do realize it's not necessarily designed to turn kids into pro athletes, but instead to really gain from the athletic experience. So whenever it ends, you feel like you've gotten the most from it. But I've also got some other non-sport products and different things that people can look over. I've got a lifelong theory I've been working on called Optimal Balance, helping people identify and effectively respond to the stressors in their life. Always involved in some new project, so I certainly encourage people to go to the site and check it out.
When we come back, maybe you could talk some more about Optimal Balance, but why don't you start right now? We've got still a couple of minutes.
Sure. You know, the basic idea behind Optimal Balance is to have us regularly take snapshots of our lives and where we are at different points in our lives and examine the things that we truly value. And, you know, if you go across the lifespan, for most of us, the things that we valued at 16, 18, 20 years old are very different at 40 and even more different at 60 or 80. And I think what's tough for people is we sometimes get, you know, grooved into patterns, and we don't allow ourselves to grow intellectually as our values change. And so Optimal Balance is an idea about making time for the things that we often talk about getting around to. And so many of us have these hobbies and interests that if we only had a few minutes, we'd do it. And my model suggests that we need to prioritize those things, even if it's only 20 or 30 minutes a week that you like to draw or paint or do something creative. I have found it to be remarkably effective and therapeutic when people prioritize those things. It completes them. Even if you don't make any money or recognition from it, it just makes you feel better as a person. So I kind of talk about that through the model of Optimal Balance.
What are some of the common things that people view that they need in their balance that they haven't been doing?
Well, I think it's these elective type things that get pushed off the table. I mean, we've all got our responsibility, our fixed blocks of, you know, we have careers, we have family, we have other social responsibilities in some cases. But it's the things that we really enjoy doing that I find we often get away from. And these are often creative endeavors. And I think people sometimes have guilt in those endeavors because, you know, why would I make time to do a painting each week or write poetry or do things like that? There's no payoff for that. When I would argue there's a huge payoff to that. I think it allows you to be you. And when you feel good about who you are, your self-concept is positive, all of your thinking and behaviors gravitate upward. And it just makes you a more successful person in everything you do.
Well, I certainly agree with that. And it is a constant struggle. You know, I love to write, and I love to write books, and I'm working on a book now that's with an artist. It's going to be a cartoon-like book about how to overcome guilt, shame, and anxiety. I'm really enjoying it. But, boy, it becomes the last priority behind about 10 or 15 duties and obligations, all of which are important and many of which are fun. But the things that we truly cherish in life, it's so important to really, really work hard to keep them alive. Well, before we go to break, let me remind you how you can make your day and make my day. And that's by coming up to me at the conference and saying, Peter, I heard you talk about it on the radio. I decided to come from Berkeley, or decided to come from Wyoming or Idaho to visit you and shake your hands at the conference and be inspired in the things I believe. So April 26th through 28th, April 26th through 28th, coming up. It's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It's a really cool hotel, really good ambience, really a delightful place to be. Check it out on empathictherapy.org or go to Bregan.com. And I'm going to be really reminding you in my next couple of radio shows as time comes. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. My guest is Chris Stankovich, founder of Advanced Human Performance Systems. You can find him real easy by just plugging in Stankovich or Chris Stankovich or Dr. Chris Stankovich. I just had a thought about something that would be very interesting to talk about. The final game of the streak of LeBron James and his basketball team.
Now, you know that's a hot subject here in Ohio, right, Peter?
Yes.
I think many folks from Ohio are still bothered by the decision a few years ago, so he's a tough one to talk about here.
Well, I think this is very interesting because it provides a kind of model for success and failure. I mean, here's a man. And, of course, he's not alone. I mean, you could tell people more about the game, I think, than, much more than I could about the game and Wade and all the various players. But one of the things that struck me about the game, and just to tune people into what it was about, it was, I guess, the game, they were at their 27th victory. Were they going for the 27th in a row? Or had they had 27?
I think they had 26. I think they were going for 28. I believe it was, yeah.
And that had already given them the second longest basketball streak ever.
Right.
And in addition, they weren't far away from the Los Angeles Lakers from decades ago, who held the 33-game record. And things are much, much harder now. In the leagues, competing between the teams, there are many more teams. They have to play each other much more. It's much more exhausting. So the odds on anybody getting up to 27, let alone breaking the 33, were really a big deal.
Right.
One of the things that interested me was watching LeBron James during arguably one of the most important games of his entire career. He would probably think so. And that something happened in the game where he started to feel like a victim. Did you notice that?
No, I don't. I heard a little bit about it, but I didn't see that game.
Well, I haven't. Oh, he didn't see it. Well, there comes a, you know, he's getting beat up all the time, of course. People are banging into him and jumping on him. But he's twice as strong as anybody. He's like an ox among sheep.
Right.
He's so much stronger. He's not the tallest, but he's very tall and very large and very heavy. Yeah. And I noticed, I thought, my God, I think they are going to lose this game because something was going on with him where he's complaining more and more to the referee. And then finally, he actually commits a very obvious angry foul by barging into the chest of one of the other players at a critical time toward the end of the game, as if to say, I'm on the street and I'm not going to let you get away with this. And he literally puts his shoulder down and bangs somebody in the chest, this huge guy. Now, the guy
that
who banged
I did,
his own.
Yeah, I saw that part.
All right. Well, you know, I thought this was so interesting because, you know, what was happening there? How much did the breaking of the streak involve LeBron James getting overtired, over-irritable, tired of getting beat up on, and losing his concentration?
You know, there's so many moving pieces to a streak of that length. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head. Yes, including luck. And, you know, I know for a fact that when you've got a team like the Miami Heat on a 20-25-game winning streak coming into your building, I mean, that's your Super Bowl. You know, that. So the opponents are all getting up for you. You've got to have everybody pulling in the same direction. You know, like you said, you've got to have a little luck. I mean, just the travel schedule today compared to the early 70s when the Lakers had that streak, it's so much more difficult. Yeah, there's a lot. It was a very impressive streak. But I'll tell you what's even more intriguing since you bring up LeBron James, and I think, again, there's a broader view to this whole thing. You know, he has more or less successfully rehabilitated his image. And if you think about what it was after the decision, you know, I sometimes teach sports.
Well, tell people what that was. After he left Cleveland, where he'd grown up as a kid, as I remember,
right.
Played ball, went to play for Cleveland, the team was bad, and he left.
Yeah, well, the team, you know, it seemed as though they were doing what they could to build a winner around him, and for whatever reason, you know, and he had his choice. It was his free agency year, and he was able to do whatever he wanted. No one faulted him for that necessarily, but he went with ESPN. They had a big, you know, primetime TV show in order to make his announcement, and, you know, here he was in front of the world, and he, you know, chose to go to Miami, and great for the fans in Miami, but it really delivered a blow to folks from Cleveland, a hardworking city, great fans, people who had supported him, and, you know, a lot of folks, a lot of sports fans worldwide, not just here in Ohio, really felt that that was a classless move. And so, you know, his image just plummeted. And what I find really interesting, and there's a segue into Tiger Woods in a moment, is that, you know, what LeBron has done in the years since then, he's won. He's won a championship. He's been a part of a 27-game winning streak. You know, love him or hate him, you have to respect the fact that he's evolved into the greatest player in the game today. Tiger Woods has also shown the ability to rehabilitate an image. In fact, his sponsor Nike just had an ad I blogged about a couple weeks ago, something to the effect of winning, you know, makes everything okay. And I think it does speak to our American culture and how quickly we forgive and forget things that at one time we were bothered by, sometimes deeply bothered by. But if you win, if you're successful, we typically forget about those things. In fact, the challenge that Lance Armstrong faces, many believe, is the fact that he's no longer able to compete at the level he used to, meaning he can't just go out, even if he's drug-free, and win another Tour de France to make people forget about it. You know, these things happened at the end of his career, and in psychology we know about the recency effect of usually what we hold on to, and I think that's what people are going to remember Lance for.
Yeah, it's like O.J. Simpson. He was too old to go back and play football and redeem himself.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
There's another part of this that fits with the psychological issues to me. When you mentioned Tiger Woods. Now, Tiger, as I recall, was really at the peak. He was the player when the scandals broke surrounding him and his wife and his sexual escapades. He was at the very top, wasn't he?
Right, yes.
And then his career collapses when something happens to him, whether it's the undermining of his family life, I guess his wife left him eventually, or whether it's the adverse publicity. But why wasn't a man like Tiger Woods able to go ahead and maintain his level of sport, even though something's happened to his image, something's happened to his family life? It's a very important issue about the importance of social relationships.
There's two big pieces to that story, in my opinion. One was the fact that, you know, his focus became splintered. You know, I think when you have something of that magnitude happen, you know, your family's breaking up, you're all over the news for these, you know, terrible escapades, and it seemed like not a week went by where some other new audio recording or mistress came out talking about what, you know, he had been involved with. So I think his own focus was very splintered. But I'll tell you, another interesting thing happened, Peter, and looking back, it's pretty clear that this occurred, is that the competition, who prior to Tiger Woods' transgressions, you know, largely stood in fear of this guy. You know, most of the tournaments Tiger Woods entered were his to lose. The competition, you know, was in such awe. And I think what happened during that time was increasingly more of his competitors started to believe in themselves, have greater levels of confidence, they had sharper focus. And pretty soon, a couple of these guys started winning, and that, again, that whole paradigm changed where, you know, it wasn't just assumed Tiger Woods would win. And I think, you know, in all fairness, I think Woods has done an admirable job of fighting back to get on top. Now, he still hasn't won a major, and he still trails, you know, in the big picture for the all-time leader. But, you know, he's playing a lot better, that's for sure.
And did he get injured shortly after these personal catastrophes?
Well, they've talked about some of these injuries, and, you know, without knowing him personally, I don't know how serious they were or not. But in my opinion, I think the physical injuries paled in comparison to the issues that he dealt with mentally and emotionally. I think that was just overwhelming, and it was evident. I think even in some of the interviews that he was conducting, he was a lot shorter with people. You know, there was a
he looked like hell, didn't he? He looked terrible.
Looked different. He did. Yeah, and I just think that he was battling more between the years than he was physical injuries.
Yeah. Yeah, life matters. Our relationships with people matter. They matter whether we're 15 years old trying to shoot baskets, or we're professional sports stars, or we're politicians, or I guess if we're sports trainers like you and psychiatric reformers like me. The underpinnings of relationship are just so key to everything that goes on with us.
Yeah, and you're right. And even today, we've got another one of these big stories that has come out near your way, actually, over there at Rutgers. The men's basketball coach was fired earlier today, and I just wrote a blog on it this morning about you know, his methodologies for coaching. There's a video now that ESPN has put out, and it shows the coach, you know, just going off on verbal tirades and slandering his players and throwing a basketball at them. And, you know, it again brings up the question, not just about sports leadership and coaching, but leadership in general. And, you know, this applies to any of your listeners today who are just in the business world or, you know, in other capacities beyond sports. How you lead people, you know, do you lead them through encouragement and positive reinforcement and shaping behaviors that way? Or do you lead them through intimidation and humiliation? And, you know, of course, I'm going to suggest that the first way is a lot better way. I think it's more humane, and I think you get more from people when you respect them and treat them right.
It's interesting. I mean, this huge contrast. By the way, Chris, I've never talked sports on the air before.
You're doing great.
I've never done this before in my life. I'm thinking about the contrast in basketball coaches. There was the famous coach, I think, from Texas, who would throw chairs and be enraged.
Bobby Knight.
Mm-hmm. And where did he coach? He coached two places because he got fired from one.
Correct. He was originally at Indiana, and he was there for many, many years. And then, yes, he was fired from Indiana, ended up at Texas Tech, I believe.
Yeah. And then you have somebody like Coach K at Duke, who... He looks like the picture of a solemnity, and other coaches. You know, what balance is there in sports today between the Coach Knight and the Coach K, the two different Coach Ks?
Well, you know, let me first make a comment before I answer that. You know, you mentioned this is the first time you've done sports on the show, but I would encourage your listeners to think about, I mean, probably the vast majority of listeners to this show are involved in sports in some capacity. They either are parents of a child in sports, have a niece, nephew, neighbor, somebody, you know. So this is an issue that goes beyond the playing field when you talk about these interpersonal dynamics and the different lessons we can learn through sports. So, yeah, I think that it's important that they kind of view what we're talking about through that lens. But as far as the different styles go, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research out there in the sports psychology world trying to develop a prototype for a successful coach, and I don't know that one exists. I mean, you could certainly – it depends on what you're measuring. You know, if at the end of the day you're measuring victories, well, Coach K and Bobby Knight are probably in the same discussion as far as the amount of wins they had over their career. But their manner in which they got those wins was 180 degree apart, if you study that. So I don't know that there's one clear-cut way of doing it.
Probably being more kind and mature in relating to your players teaches them to expect that in life and to expect respect and to respect other people, and that will definitely enhance your life and probably your success. Whereas, enduring a Coach Knight is going to teach you a combination of submissiveness and suppressed rage, I would think.
Oh, yeah, And, you know, I just read an article that's going to be coming out in an Ohio magazine this spring, and it talks about the responsibilities of coaches and, you know, really being aware. And I think this is another good thing for listeners, because many of your listeners are probably volunteer coaches at the local, you know, sports league or at the school. And, you know, what we do and even what we don't do becomes very impressionable on kids. You know, if you look at social learning theory, kids learn by watching. And it's not only, important to note when a coach throws a chair or grabs a player, but, you know, coaches who go through a locker room and hear kids using profanity or discriminatory remarks and not do anything, you know, that speaks volumes. It teaches the kids what the coach's tolerance level is and how low that is and what they can get away with. And so, you know, there's a lot of complexities, I think, whether you're a teacher or a coach or in any position working with kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us some more about, well, I don't know, I really like this subject. It's just a new one for me. I like, you know, I watch sports all the time on TV, and, my wife and I, we sort of try to divvy it up. 85% of the time we watch music competition shows because she loves them, and then she'll get a book out, and some percentage of the time I get to watch sports, especially if she knows it's March Madness or something like that. But I feel that the sporting scene and the sports writers, who I think are the best writers, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm often just take a moment and read aloud to Ginger a sports column. The writing is so good. That arena just has so many lessons in it about life. And I think one of the reasons it has those lessons is that sports, unlike the rest of life, is conducted according to rules. We got the Ten Commandments in this life. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we're trying to get away from them, there's some of the rules. But we have really specific rules, fine rules about, you know, where the basketball has to be on the rim before another player can touch it and put it back in the basket, and rules about levels of fouls and at what point you get into serious trouble for a level two foul? What is that called?
Flagrant foul, yeah.
Yeah, flagrant two, I think it is.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yeah.
There's all the rules, and so you get to see people working within those rules to their very best. Now, there's still judgment on the part of coaches and judgment in particular on the part of the referees, and that's where you find the frustration and the rage, because the rules can't be enforced perfectly, but they're enforced so much better than in life, and they're enforced in public, and they're enforced in front of millions and millions of people. So I think that one of the beauties of sports is we get to watch people try to be their best in a setting that's a real level playing field, because there's just the same rules for everybody.
Well, that's right.
Very
interesting. And there's another interesting caveat to sports that we don't often think about, and that is a very unique type of stress identified as burst stress. You know, most of us in our careers, we don't usually have events that happen spontaneously, events that we haven't planned for. You know, most of us live in fairly regulated lives. But when it comes to certain careers, police officers, paramedics, firefighters, and I would include athletics in this group, You've got the type of stressors that emerge. They're often unforeseen. They often demand immediate response. Often emotions replace any kind of logical thinking because you just don't have the time. And I think it explains, in large part, why we see some of this acting out, particularly when it comes to parents in youth sports. And I know we haven't really gone there today. Maybe we'll save that for the next show. But, you know, so many times when a parent acts out at a youth sporting event, they're not bad people. They get caught up. Something quickly happens, something they didn't plan for. They're emotionally charged because it's their child out there. And before you know it, they say something or throw something or grab someone. And, you know, I would say in the vast majority of these cases, the folks who commit these crimes, so to speak, terribly regret it the next day. But, you know, again, it's that burst stress and things happen quickly in sports, and you're not always prepared to handle those situations.
Yes. Did you see the that terrible broken leg incident?
I have to tell you, we've been talking about that since Sunday, and I have to admit to you, Peter, I have not watched that. I'm still struggling with the Joe Theismann compound fracture in 1985, so I can't watch that video. I saw the expressions of the players on the court, and that was enough for me to illustrate that was horrific.
Yeah, I actually was watching the game, and now I can't even remember. It was the final eight. And I'm trying to remember, but I think the ball player's name was Weir.
Weir was his last name.
Yeah, Weir. And it was the University of Kentucky was playing.
No, it was Louisville and
Louisville.
Gosh, who was it that they were playing? Was it Duke?
Oh God, I'm just trying to look it up.
I missed the game. Yeah.
It was Duke because I remember Coach K's expression.
Yeah.
Coaches were crying. The players were crying. There was a huge break in time. People were weeping. And what it was, he just came down on his foot and torqued it. He just jumped up to block, I think. Mm-hmm. Came down his foot. No one heard him. And as his coach put it later, his leg moved and his foot didn't. And you could see the right angle of the broken leg. It looked like a right angle. And then they stopped showing it. And the players on both sides, one of the Kentucky players was weeping openly at what had happened. And it speaks to this unexpected event, and it can be a very powerful event. And to see the human responses.
And you know what will be the greater challenge for this young man moving forward? Ironically, the challenges that he faces now will be a lot more between the ears, more mental stressors moving forward than physical. And this is another good thing for listeners to tune into if they've got a son or daughter who's had a sport-related injury. In most cases, the pain subsides relatively quickly. The body heals itself fairly quickly over time. But getting back out there again and having the confidence to do those things again, you know, I think about that player you're talking about from Sunday, and I think about just how overwhelming and scary it's going to be the first time he gets back out there and goes through the drills again, you know, just thinking about what he experienced. And in my practice, I see that quite a bit. Coaches will call and they can't understand because the player has been signed off to practice again. He's physically healthy. But yet he's tentative, and he's scared, and he's not playing with confidence. And really all of that has to do with the mental aspects of injury recovery.
Yeah, and just to let people know, in this case, his joints weren't injured. He had a compound fracture, which means that it broke through the skin.
Yeah.
And it was very, very severe. But the doctors reported that it was less severe than many, many knee and injuries in particular, because the bones will heal. Rod was put in, the bones will heal. And they expected him within about a year to be able to play basketball again.
Yeah.
So just to reassure people. But what a community experience it was. What a national experience was.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing the coaches caring so much, players on both sides shocked and caring. And then, of course, the game goes on.
Yeah,
and Kentucky,
that's right.
The Kentucky overpowered the wounded team for a few minutes, and then they got themselves together and they won the game without one of their best players. So
yeah.
It's just that sports world is really, really interesting. Chris, we've got just a minute or two to go, and let me remind folks again, I'm talking to Chris Stankovich. You can easily find him on the web. Just put in Stankovich and you'll get him. And he's a sports trainer. He's innovative. He's done a lot of interesting development of programs, books, and processes. He gets to be on even more famous shows than mine. And he's just a lot of fun to talk to. And don't forget the conference, April 26th through 28th. You can come and meet a lot of wonderful folks here in Syracuse, New York. Go to empathictherapy.org. So having set that aside, Chris, some closing thoughts from you, if you have the energy.
I do have the energy. And, you know, I want to thank you again for reaching out and inviting me to be a part of your show today. You've heard me in the past talk about my personal appreciation for the great work that you do in raising awareness. You know, I cannot express to you enough how important it is, the work that you're doing in helping people become better educated about more natural and healthier and safer ways to rehabilitate any kind of emotional distress they're experiencing. I just can't say enough, and I really
thank
appreciate
you,
our friendship.
Thank you very, very much, and goodbye, folks, and I'll see you at the conference, but I'll talk to you again next week, Wednesday at 4 p.m. Bye-bye now.